shorter U.S. life expectancies, AFib dangers for women, do tighter EMS protocols even work, and we'll have a special look at hemorrhage control and tourniquet use in a crossover episode from the Disaster Podcast. If that's what you're looking for, you found it right here on this week's episode of the MedicCast.
Transmitters? We don't need no stinking transmitters!
This is the MedicCast, a podcast for EMS providers by EMS providers, featuring EMS news, products, tips, tricks, and commentary. So grab your gear and glove up! Here's today's show with the pod medic, Jamie Davis!
Well, good day and welcome to this week's episode of the MedicCast. I'm your host, Jamie Davis, the pod medic, and I'd like to take this opportunity to say hey and welcome you to this week's show. In this week's EMS news items, including a look at why Americans have shorter life expectancies, we're going to be looking at how that happens and how it is compared to other industrial companies or countries. Can EMS do anything to improve these death rates? Then in this week's special tip segment, we have a discussion on hemorrhage and bleeding control with tools like tourniquets and other things that are new out there on the marketplace. This comes from the Disaster Podcast. There are numerous things on the market to manage severe bleeding, including several commercial tourniquets we'll be discussing, but which ones are best? Well, we're going to find out some more about that later on in the show after the news. Before we get to that, though, I do want to make sure you do a couple of things. You need to follow up on the links and information you get from me here over at the MedicCast blog at mediccast.com/blog. There's a show notes link at the top of the page. You can click that and it'll take you to the most recent episode. You can scroll down and find other previous episodes if you're looking for something. You can search for it on the site, but I want you to check out the things I talk about in the show so that you understand what's going on there. Take some time and follow up on it, and then make sure you understand how it applies to your own EMS practice and protocols. If you still want to get back in touch with me, I'd love to hear from you, so make sure you do so. You can always email me directly at podmedic@mac.com. Shoot me an email with your questions and comments on an episode. Maybe you have an idea for a future episode or an interview idea for somebody for me to talk to. Either way, I work hard to respond back to all those emails that come in, and I will get back to you as well, so please keep them coming. Also, I'll be recording interviews in the physio control booth at EMS Today at the end of this month at EMS Today in Baltimore. So if you want to meet, come on by the physio control booth and say hi. Check out the amazing EMS patient care tools that are there in the physio control booth while you're hanging out. And I look forward to seeing you there. So wait for me to finish the interview if I'm doing one, and then come over and say hi. Let's get into the rest of the show with the news. It is coming up in just a sec. First up in our news this week for EMS providers like EMTs and paramedics, let's take a look at a new report on life expectancies in the industrialized world. There's bad news for the Americans in this report. We can expect to live an average of 2 fewer years than most of the others based on the latest data released by the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, the CDC, and the World Health Organization. Any guesses on why that is? Well, according to the data from all the countries in the study, the increased deaths in the United States come from car crashes, shootings, and drug overdoses. Now, those three causes of death account for about 50% of the difference in life expectancy for men and about 20% of life expectancy difference for women. And that means if we reduce the amount of deaths just from these causes, we could gain an average of 1 more year in life expectancy just from those changes. And it's even more of an impact than that, since those deaths' causes are usually affecting younger people who have many more productive years of life ahead of them, so there's a profound economic impact from these causes of death as well. Now, this is important to EMS providers like us out there in the field because these are all areas where we are the first medical professionals who are on hand to treat many of these patients. Our quick recognition of life threats and providing the definitive treatment needed can improve survival rates immensely. Getting hemorrhages under control, decompressing pneumothorax injuries, administering things like naloxone are all life-saving procedures in the EMS realm of treatment. The better we are, the more patients survive. So I urge you to read this article and then look at how you can improve your care and assessment skills for these, your most critical patients. What can you do to improve? Next up in the news for EMTs and paramedics is a look at how heart disease affects men and women differently. Now, there's a new study out there I found reported over at healthday.com that proposes that women are in more danger from atrial fibrillation, or AFib, than their male counterparts. According to the article in the study, the women are more at risk for things like stroke, heart failure, heart attack, and cardiac arrest when they have a pre-existing case of AFib. In fact, they are likely to twice as much suffer serious side effects than men. The study's authors looked at numerous other cardiac studies and looked at about 4.3 million patients in those studies. And what it is this widespread cardiac dysrhythmia affects so many people, about 33 million people worldwide. And researchers and experts propose that women do worse as far as outcomes from AFib because they experience different symptoms from men. And this means they may not be getting diagnosed as early as men are for this aberrant heart rhythm. So they get to be in a more advanced stage of heart disease when they do get diagnosed. Now, another issue is not what everyone with a disorder out there are doing, but that they're not taking their drugs necessarily to fight the dangerous side effects. Most of them should be on anticoagulants to reduce the risk of throwing a clot from their atria into the lungs, heart, or brain. Other effective treatments are out there, though. They can improve their diet, increase their exercise levels, control blood pressure and cholesterol. So be aware of this with your female AFib patients and make sure you're on extra careful watch because of this increased risk for a more serious situation while they're in your care in the back of an ambulance. Finally, I have a look at a great article I found from my friend Kelly Grayson over at EMS1.com. He wrote an article there on the differences between looser and restrictive emergency medical services protocols and the different effects on patient care. Now, he starts the article by stating that when you become a master paramedic, an experienced professional who can demonstrate mastery of the necessary assessment skills, the knowledge and treatment abilities you've developed, you can outgrow your protocols. For making that statement on social media channels, Kelly got called things like paragod and cowboy, and not in a good way. The fact is, we all should be striving to outgrow our protocols. That's what being a professional means. Protocols are written to give minimum guidance to the worst of us or the least experienced of us in EMS. Our patients demand a lot more. They demand us to be critical thinkers and thoughtful clinicians who will not treat them as some problem to be treated by the recipe cookbook that is our protocols. The best example I can think of is a lesson I got from an instructor a long time ago. He said at all times, treat the patient, not the monitor. Just because a patient technically qualifies for a certain intervention doesn't mean they should always receive that intervention. You know, you've got a patient, they're diaphoretic, they're gasping for breath, and they're tachycardic. Should they be electrically cardioverted? No, this is a guy who just finished a day's training for a marathon coming up. Now, I know that's unfair, so don't blast me on it. Hopefully, a bunch of you instantly came up with further questions that you wanted to ask and know the answers to before you made any decision about this patient. And that's my point, and Kelly's too. You have protocols to help you make decisions when you don't have other information to back up your choices. But if you have some experience, additional education, and have developed some critical thinking skills, you might make a different decision than the brand new paramedic or the guy that's just getting by. Be an EMS professional and strive to outgrow your protocols. Your medical director will likely applaud you for it. Managing hemorrhage control with a tourniquet or other EMS response tools and other quick response devices takes in-depth training. The Disaster Podcast team comes back on the MedicCast this week with a crossover segment where I chat with Dr. Joe Holly from Paragon Medical Education Group about what it takes for effective hemorrhage control and when should we jump right into dealing with tourniquets immediately. We should also talk about practicing the use of different things like tourniquets and what is going to make it most effective. Now remember, folks, the Disaster Podcast is an audio podcast, so if you're watching the video version of the show, I'm going to disappear and you're just going to see their logo. But here's that segment on hemorrhage control and tourniquet use from the Disaster Podcast, coming up next. Well, good day and welcome back to another episode here of the Disaster Podcast. I'm your host, Jamie Davis, the Pod Medic, and I'm happy to hear all of your smiling, breathing voices out there just coming back to me through the speakers here. At least I'm imagining that. I have to do that when you podcast. You're just staring at a blank computer screen half the time. But at least I have the ability to be joined by my spectacular co-host, Sam Bradley. Hey, Sam.
Hey, Jamie, you're a little weird tonight. That was a little weird.
Should I start over again? Was it that
No,
weird?
No, I
okay.
Kidding.
No, it's cool. No, it's just, you know, the whole podcasting thing, people don't realize you sit here and you talk to yourself for an hour, and sometimes you have a co-host and a guest, and sometimes you don't. And so it's just one of those things. But I know you guys have been getting some precipitation continuously out there in California. You're just not used to this.
Yeah, and you're right. It would be kind of cool if we actually could see who's listening out there. That would be kind of neat. Yeah, it's the El Nino is definitely here. It's been pretty insane. We have a new record based out of San Francisco that we're in the 16th straight day of rain at some level. And that hasn't been seen for 20 some odd years. And I think it was Wednesday night. Usually out here, if we get any kind of deluge, it lasts like 5 minutes. It rained all night, hour after hour after hour, and wreaked some real havoc. We had a lot of flooding. And as I understand it from you, that storm is wreaking havoc as it goes east, and it's hitting Dr. Joe's area, and it's heading for you, right?
Yeah, well, we're looking at potential, and again, you never know, potential large snowstorm hitting the Mid-Atlantic area Friday into Saturday. And it really is going to depend on where this low pressure system stalls off the coast, how close it is to the coast, and then where north-south it stalls. So all those things, if it all happens in just a certain way, we could get a couple of feet of snow, or we could get a light dusting and a little bit of rain and freezing sleet. So we just don't know. It's typical winter here in Maryland. We're used to this. We kind of all laugh about everybody running out and getting milk and bread and freaking out, and then nothing happens. So we'll see.
So, Joe, are you getting any of that down in Memphis?
It's nice and cold down here, and there's a chance of a little bit of wintry precipitation over the next day or so. But, you know, I think the chances are pretty slim we're going to get much of anything except just some nice cold temps.
Well, I sure hope that there's nothing major going to happen the last few days of the month when we have to go drive from here to Colorado. It's a little scary because, again, like you said, Jamie, the weather is, you just don't know from one day to the next. Well, what you're going to get. So
we've talked, you know, but we've talked about just being prepared and checking your weather reports before you leave to go anywhere and having, you know, basic supplies with you. So I don't know if you're planning on keeping a load of course, you'll have just about everything with you when you make the move. So you won't be sure.
Yeah, but can I access it?
That's true.
That's the key point. No, I am very good about keeping certain disaster supplies in my vehicle at all times. I'm just going to have to make sure I switch it out so I'm more winterized. You know, make sure there's extra blankets and warming things. And I have to really kind of rethink everything I need for cold weather because I haven't lived in cold weather for quite a while. So I got to work on that. But yeah, stuff that's accessible, that would be good.
Definitely. Well, wishing you luck on your move as you get into that direction. And we're also excited, Joe, to be talking with you tonight about hemorrhage control again and some things about tourniquets, because we've got EMS Today coming up and you've got that sold out, you know, filled by demand segment on active shooter drills that Paragon's putting on. And that hemorrhage control is going to be a major part of that.
That it is, and you're right. We're excited to know that we're already sold out for our pre-conference at EMS Today on the active shooter. And hemorrhage control obviously is a significant issue in any active shooter event. As a matter of fact, there's now a new initiative out from the president in the White House called Stop the Bleed. And I think the website is stopthebleed.org, but there's some stuff beginning to happen at the federal level to help encourage preparation for an event like that, unfortunately, but preparation nonetheless, including things like pre-staging hemorrhage control products like tourniquets and that sort of stuff in areas of mass gathering, and some public education kind of along the lines of basic CPR and that sort of stuff on how to help take care of and assist victims of mass shootings. So scary world we live in now, but at least some proactive stuff is beginning to happen.
Well, and that's the neat thing, Joe, about what you guys have been doing actually for quite a long time at Paragon. And I think this active shooter, which is a new piece of what you're doing, is at least as far as the conference circuit is concerned, is really going to be helpful, because I don't think there's anything better than just immersion therapy, interactive training, or the experience, as you call it. And, you know, you've done so much with cadavers. You're still working on that as far as actually being able to use human tissue and doing some research on that kind of thing. And, yeah, I think this is going to be truly awesome. I think you're going to be asked to do this a lot. And I think the conferences are a great forum for people, you know, to come. And besides the conference itself, this is something they can walk away with a lot of new information. So it's pretty awesome.
That's certainly the goal. And, you know, the more I get a chance to work with these products, the more I appreciate that while the majority of them are not technically difficult things to do, there are an awful lot of very subtle things to know and be familiar with to make you fast and efficient in the use of them. And that, especially in a stressful situation, that folks are going to take a lot more time than they think they are to utilize these products to get bleeding under control. And, you know, it's something that shouldn't take but 30 seconds to do, but we routinely see folks spending 4 and 5 minutes trying to get, you know, the bleeding stopped using a product that they think they feel pretty comfortable with. So I think it's one of those things where we don't spend enough time on the all important subtle nuances of the use of those products.
I mean, it's just a question of practice. I mean, because I think a lot of people look at a tourniquet and they go, oh, that's a pretty simple device. It's got Velcro, it's got its windlass. I know how that works. And they put it back in its packaging and they store it in their bag and they feel like they're ready to use it. But there's a lot more to it than that.
Oh, I think you're exactly right, Jamie. You know, I think if you think of a tourniquet in its very rudimentary and earliest inception, you know, you think of a band of some sort that you wrap around an extremity, and you put a stick, you know, in the loop, and you begin twisting the stick until it gets tight enough to, you know, stop circulation. Unfortunately, commercial tourniquets don't really work like that. The concept is still the same, but what's very different is that the windlass is really only good for about maybe an inch and a half or so of additional tightening of the band, and after that, you're stuck. I mean, you've turned it all you can turn it. And it usually is about 3 half turns, and that's about all it's going to do. And so what becomes really important there is making certain that when you place that tourniquet, the initial tightening of the strap that goes around the extremity in a much tighter fashion than most folks think is absolutely vital to be certain that when you crank that windlass, you know, 3 half turns, you're done. You know, that's enough to control the hemorrhage. What I worry about in active shooter situations is that you put it on, it's a little too loose, you turn the windlass, you know, 3 half turns, they're still bleeding, you try to do it a little bit more, it still doesn't work, you have to untwist the windlass, you have to grab the strap and tighten the thing up again, and then try tightening the windlass again. And that's where the, you know, 30-second application is now 5 minutes, and the bleeding is still not stopped. So,
Joe, how effective is a blood pressure cuff? I know some people feel that's a viable alternative if you shouldn't have a tourniquet or maybe with a tourniquet. Is there some, I've never really had to do that, so I can't really speak.
Yeah, I think the challenges with blood pressure cuffs is that, will they work? Yes, but there are a lot of limitations there. You know, it's tough to get a blood pressure cuff to remain inflated. Obviously, the inflated bladder on a blood pressure cuff is only on maybe, you know, one quarter of the entire, you know, band that goes around your arm. And so sort of placement of that balloon can make a very big difference. If you've got it in the wrong spot, the Velcro may or may not be adequate to maintain its grip under significant increases in, you know, pressure. I mean, you got to blow that thing up higher than systolic blood pressure, obviously, to get it to work. And then you have to actually monitor it continuously once you've got it on there, because its tendency is to leak down over time, and of course, bleeding is going to start again. And, you know, if you're trying to take care of patients, you really sort of need a blood pressure cuff to assess blood pressure. So,
yeah.
You know, is it a potential temporizing measure? Sure. But I think it's also not, it's not a great substitute for a tourniquet. It might buy you a little time if it's all you got, but it's got its own set of challenges associated with it.
You know, well, another... Go ahead, Jamie.
It's insane. It's just interesting because I've seen people use that method. I've also, you know, I teach a first aid class in a local college that's actually a 3-credit class for first aid, CPR, some anatomy and physiology, and some prevention information. But during the section we talk about tourniquets, I talk about how to apply them. We have a lot of veterans that come through the community college program. And when I get one of them in my class, I you know, when I ask, has anyone ever learned how to put a tourniquet on? Boy, I can tell the veterans right away, because they cinch that sucker up tight right away. They make it as tight as they can make it before they ever put the Velcro down. And then they, you know, they turn the windlass a half turn. Well, good grief, a half turn on windlass when it's that tight is a lot. And that's the, you know, that's how I can tell the difference. They've been trained and told how to apply a tourniquet and clearly have practiced it. And that combat application, the need to do that has ingrained in them the necessity to learn the job correctly. We've not done that in EMS over the years. We've rudimentally shown how to build a tourniquet out of a cravat and a stick. And we go, okay, this is all you need to know, and that's it. And we've really, I think, short-suited a lot of people in their education out there. So I'm so glad that Paragon's doing this, because this is where, you know, this is where that experiential training is really important.
You know, this reminds me, too, because we talked about our Urban Shield exercise that we have out here in California. And I was tasked with teaching people how to stop an arterial bleed. And fortunately, the other trainers I have are PJs. So just like you were saying, Jamie, these guys come from they've actually used this in the field. And when you get people just taking any kind of dressing and plopping it on a wound and thinking they're going to wrap it and that's going to work, boy, these guys showed me you got to dig your hand in there almost like you're going to grab that artery with your fingers. Then you start packing, and you keep packing and packing and packing until you've got so much in there, it's about ready to explode, you know. And people don't understand how much pressure you actually need when you have an arterial bleed. Would you agree with that, Joe?
Oh, I would definitely. There's no question that aggressiveness is necessary to quickly get those arterial bleeds under control. And I think, you know, I think back to what Jamie was saying earlier about tourniquets, you know, I think for the vast majority of, particularly the lay public, I guess, you know, the idea of a tourniquet being a big loop around an extremity that you put a stick in and you start twisting, you know, that's essentially an infinite tourniquet. I mean, as long as you twist that stick, it's going to get tighter. But, you know, now what we're talking about doing is utilizing commercial products which don't work that way. They are not infinite tourniquets via the windlass. You have to get that initial band really tight, and then the windlass just kind of finishes it off. And I think we have not done a good job, from the public's use of those products, and really even the professionals' use of those products, and really making that difference clear in how those two things work. You know, kind of the old school, you know, rope around the leg with a stick in it.
Well, and let's face it, most of the people that teach have never had an arterial bleed. They just aren't that common. So to really have it like the military, have a true understanding of what it takes to stop one, if you don't understand that yourself, you're not going to be passing that on to students. Maybe Jamie has a better concept of that, fortunately, so his students. Well, and like he said, if you get military in your class, there's nothing better than that, because I learned a lot from the guys I worked with. I wouldn't do it nearly as well as if they hadn't been there. So that was really helpful.
Yeah, no question. That experience makes all the difference. And you know, those guys have experienced it enough to appreciate the subtleties and understand why they have to do it that way in order for it to work, because they've learned those subtleties that I think the vast majority of EMS folks and certainly the lay public don't understand at all.
So what are some of the devices that are commercially available out there? I mean, is there one that's better than the others? I mean, they all seem, at least the ones that are straps and windlass versions, they all seem to be essentially the same design.
Well, there's some very interesting differences between them. And, I think it depends a little bit on sort of what the initial design was for. So, you know, if you look at, there's the CAT combat application tourniquet and the soft T, and I'm not going to name all the brands because there's a lot of them out there. You know, some of them have a Velcro on the strap, and some don't. The ones with Velcro on them tend to be a little bit easier for self-application. Because the Velcro kind of provides that extra hand to help hold the strap. But if you're trying to put one of those tourniquets with the Velcro on the strap, and in the past with some of those, I think the designs now have been updated some, but there's a lot of them out there in the world already. The Velcro type tourniquets, when you were trying to use them on the lower extremities, you had to feed the strap through the buckle twice. You had to get sort of two bites on the buckle to provide adequate traction to hold against the amount of tension that you were going to need to put on that. You couldn't just feed it through one side of the buckle and then expect that the Velcro was going to hold it, because it was going to come apart. So when you feed it through both sides of the buckle, the Velcro becomes very much a hindrance to getting the buckle, to getting the strap tight. So it's not so good for the lower extremity, but it's pretty good for the upper extremity, and it's pretty good if you're putting it on yourself, but it's less good if you're putting it on your partner, as opposed to some of the others that don't have the Velcro on them. And have a hook or something like that. Now, I know there have been some changes on the Velcro-based ones now to make the buckle a little bit different, so that you don't have to worry about, you know, feeding it through both sides versus just one side. There's enough tension there to maintain against a, you know, proper use of the tourniquet on a lower extremity. So, we see a lot of those different little things pop up. There are several new ones on the market now that have kind of a ratcheting type device that allows them to tighten, which I think, you know, might have some advantages on the civilian side, in that they're sort of less dependent on the initial application piece. In other words, the ratchet has more works over a wider distance, I think, than the windlass seems to, and so might be better if you didn't get the initial strap tight enough to be able to take it all up with the ratcheting type. But of course, you got to understand how that works, and you got to have it in the first place. And I haven't seen too many of that design out yet. It's beginning to show up in the sales market, but I haven't seen it too much out in the street just yet. So
Joe, are you going to be using some of these different devices on your active shooter drill at EMS today?
Yeah, that's our hope, is that we'll have several of those different kinds there and be able to show folks some of those differences and let folks actually try putting them on each other and try to actually control the hemorrhage simulation in an actual human donor model, so that they can see how difficult it really is to get those things tight enough to get the job done.
Yeah, I kind of like the SWAT T, like you were saying. Sometimes simple is best. This is just a big, wide, stretchy piece of rubber, pretty much, and you can really cinch it down on there and tie it up. It's just a really quick and easy, big thing. I just found it. What I really liked using it for is after, when we were doing the arterial bleed, we'd pack it really well and then put that SWAT T over the top of it. And between those two things, it seemed to work really well.
Yeah, I think the packing is what makes all the difference with that product. You know, whether or not it would work without packing or not, I'm a little bit skeptical.
Yeah.
Just because it's not that it can't get tight enough. It's just a bit of a challenge to put it on and make it tight enough.
Yeah, that makes sense. So how does this translate? I think pre-hospital care is kind of slow to adopt some of these products out in the field. I know California, it's approved as an option. Some of the newer material that stops bleeding, the clotting, anti-clotting type things. I don't know about how is that working at your end, Jamie? Have they adopted that in Maryland? Are they using it in pre-hospital?
Yeah, a specific tourniquet device?
No, the clotting devices.
We haven't. That isn't really clawed on here. As far as what I've seen, it really seems to be, I think, on a case by case basis. I don't think we're prohibited from using any kind of pre impregnated gauze product, but the routine training here is just to use a plain sterile gauze. 4x4s or 2x2s or whatever we need to apply generic pressure without any kind of other mechanism. And then we are trained, like all EMS providers are trained to apply a tourniquet, and then using a commercially available tourniquet, it's really on us to be able to apply it and effectively and rapidly to make it rapidly enough to make a difference, which I think is what Joe is trying to help with, and what we're trying to help with this particular podcast.
So the question then becomes, are we training people correctly?
Yeah, it really is.
And that's the real
key
to this.
Like I said earlier, I think we've done a disservice to maybe an entire generation or two of EMS providers, because based on what I know now, and a lot of it has come from this podcast and some of the episodes we've done on hemorrhage control here in the past. But a lot of what I know now leads me to believe that I was woefully unprepared for an arterial bleed had I come in contact with one. I've had bleeding, but I've never had a spurting arterial bleed to have to clamp down on. And, I've been able to control all bleeding that I've come in contact with direct pressure. And not as much direct pressure as I've now learned would be needed for a main arterial bleed.
And I don't know if the textbooks are really caught up with, the current need, the current theories on bleeding control. Because, there was a while where tourniquets weren't in the pre-hospital protocols at all, which was weird. And then, when we went to war and they started really doing more research on it and they came back with better stuff, it came back around.
When I learned, and this has been 15, 20 years ago, and maybe you can verify this as change, Sam, I don't know. But, tourniquets were this last resort thing that
right,
you
right.
would only use when you were just basically writing off the limb. that you were, you know,
sacrifice the life for the limb, basically.
Right, right. And now we know that that's not true. You can put a tourniquet on for hours and still the limb will still survive. So we've learned some hard lessons through the result of combat injuries. And, you know, that's a good thing in some regards. But now, you know, we've got a whole group of EMS educators that came up through the ranks with the tourniquet only as a last resort. So we never really learned tourniquets. And now those people are teaching tourniquets without having learned how to apply a tourniquet for real in some cases.
That's exactly what I was thinking. We need more Joe Hollies and Paragons out there to teach them the right way.
I think there's another difference there as well, and that is if you look at an active shooter event, certainly if you look at it from the standpoint of local bystanders, lay public, you know, responding in one of those events, then, you know, you're talking about somebody who's 2 minutes into, you know, a major arterial bleed and still has, you know, pretty good blood pressure and et cetera, versus, you know, the time when we're used to showing up in one of those events, which is, you know, 10, 15 minutes later. Now they've, you know, bled out 40% of their blood volume, their pressure is 90, and, you know, that massive arterial bleed doesn't look so bad now because there's not enough pressure to squirt much out anymore.
They look pretty bad.
You know, we have sort of self-selected, I think, in many cases. The, you know, the reason that we don't use those very often is that we're slow getting to the scene. And those things change so rapidly that by the time we get, you know, 15 minutes into one of those calls, that massive arterial bleeder doesn't look so bad anymore because their pressure's 90 and, you know, the bleeding has slowed. So,
well, and that begs the question, we're teaching police to do it, which I think is really important, because it could be that they are there before we're there. But then again, it begs the question, are we teaching them correctly? So it's just a matter of who's doing that training, I guess.
Well, and who, it starts to, I start to wonder, and this is something that I've started to carry with me as a matter of routine, but is carry a tourniquet with me. It makes me wonder if this isn't something, it's small enough, it's compact enough that everybody could have one. We all carry our trauma shears. We all carry our pen light and our stethoscope, and maybe a tourniquet in the other pocket isn't a bad idea in order to have something on hand immediately to stop bleeding while we take care of other things. You know, the immediate life threats package of what you need to have with you at all times.
Ooh, good one. I like that, Jamie. What do you think, Joe? What should be in that?
Well, I think that's a great idea. We've been actually spending a fair amount of time talking about that. And, you know, I could see a kit that had some sort of tourniquet-type device in it, probably just some basic gauze. I'm not a huge believer in these impregnated gauzes, you know, with the hemorrhagic control stuff in there. It's not that they don't work. I think that they just, you know, they enhance the gauze by maybe 15%. But Sam, as you noticed, if you know how to use gauze properly, good old basic gauze works pretty well. And it's a whole lot less expensive. I think including some other products that are beginning to show up on the market, there's all kinds of you know, wound-related products that are beginning to come out. I don't have a lot of experience with any of those, and I think it, from an EMS professional standpoint, obviously it has to all be sort of done in conjunction with what your trauma folks like and what the trauma surgeons want and, you know, don't want in, stuck in a wound. There's products like the IT clamp, which works very nicely to help get a massive arterial hemorrhage under control pretty quickly. We've had a lot of experience with that. I'm very impressed with that product. I think the kit ought to have a couple pair of gloves in it. Probably some way to identify those patients quickly to those coming behind you that they need immediate transport out of those situations. So some sort of marking thing of some sort, whether that's
like a triage tag sort of thing, or some place to make notes.
Is that maybe just a red piece of ribbon or something?
Yeah, but
something that somebody can sort of see at a little distance away that person has had some care done and has been sort of tagged and.
We use ribbon. It's actually very effective because it's easy to see.
It's very quick, very easy, and it gives you a quick visual from a distance away that's been taken care of, and you can sort of move on to the next person that you see that needs help. So just try to.
You could mark the time of your tourniquet on the ribbon, really.
Absolutely.
So maybe, Jamie, we could kind of put Joe's idea on the website, maybe, our ideas for a save your life kit.
I'm taking some notes, and it'll be in the show notes for this episode. Now I'll include some links to some places. I mean, heck, you can buy a lot of this stuff right on Amazon. So if you want to put your own little emergency trauma kit, and this is going to be a small kit. This is not your go bag or whatever you might have in the back of your car or whatever. This is something you could fit in a glove box because it really isn't going to be all that much. Just enough to, if you had to treat something immediately. And wait for help to arrive, you could do that. And I think that's what we need to be prepared for.
And it'd be interesting if some of the listeners were to toss out some ideas of something we may not have thought of.
Absolutely. And we'd love to hear what your thoughts are. So that's what the comments area at disasterpodcast.com is for. Below every episode, you can leave a comment. And so, what are your thoughts about the trauma care kit and what you would have for that immediate life threats trauma kit that you would have? So think about that and maybe throw some of your thoughts out there. Just a short list of what you'd put in that type of kit. And, Joe's provided his list and what do you guys have? So we'll have to look at that. Joe, this has been I love doing these clinical topics with you because we really dig into the meat of the matter. No pun intended.
No comment.
But, folks are going to be coming in. If they haven't signed up already for the active shooter drill at EMS today, they're kind of out of luck, at least for this year. But they should definitely let the organizers know that they're sorry they missed it and they wish there was another one. In the meantime, maybe they can bring Paragon into their service, to their community, to do some organizational training and drills with their team and their jurisdiction. So how can they do that?
Well, they can certainly reach out to us at paragonmedicalgroup.com or through Facebook under the same name. We should have our brand new website up and running in about three weeks. So we're getting close on that. They can find us through the Disaster Podcast, and our Twitter feed is ParagonMedEDU. So they can get the podcast and that sort of stuff through there as well.
Excellent. And actually, by the time this episode comes out, it should be about a week away from getting that website up and running. So it'll be ready by EMS today. So if you're listening to this episode at the beginning of February or so, getting ready to head to that conference in a couple of weeks, that website should be active. So there's no reason you can't get a hold of Joe, leave a message. He's going to be bouncing around at EMS today, and maybe that's an opportunity if you're a training officer to come by and chat with he or Jim or any of the team from Paragon and find out what's going on. That would be a great opportunity for you to line up them to come in and see your jurisdiction and help you guys get things straightened out. So take that advantage of that opportunity. Sam, where can folks find you?
Well, they'll find me at EMS today lurking around the Paragon place with my camera because I think this is going to be an awesome opportunity to catch some photo. I love catching people. I love the students or the participants watching Joe. It's amazing. He can fascinate someone by doing something as simple as a bag valve mask. So I can imagine what he's going to do with bleeding. This is going to be really a lot of fun. So, and by the end of February, I'll be coming to you from Colorado. But in the meantime, the social media doesn't change. It never does. Sam Bradley or Sam Bradley 11 at the usual social media places, and most certainly at thedisasterpodcast.com.
Excellent. And of course, you can find me under the handle PodMedic in all the social media locations as well, and over at disasterpodcast.com. So check it out. get over there. If you haven't listened to previous episodes, you definitely need to check out some of the ones we've had out recently. We've had some really good episodes coming up here, and 2016 is going to be a gangbuster year for the show. We're looking forward to all the topics we have coming up for you, and I'll be at EMS today as well. So during the bulk of the conference exhibit hall days, Sam and I will be knocking around the physio control booth recording some podcasts with our camera there, doing some stand-up interviews. But if we're in between interviews, definitely come up and say hi and let us know you like the show and what you'd like to hear more of. We'd love to meet you, so stop on by and see us there. And remember to catch up and look up Joe and Jim and the rest of the Paragon team while they're there as well. You know, Sam, hemorrhage control is a disaster in and of itself when you have a major bleed.
Well, and, you know, we talk about disaster medicine. Major bleeds are a disaster no matter what scenario it's in. So it shows that disaster medicine is not our everyday medicine.
That's going to wrap up this week's episode of the MedicCast. I want to thank all of you for checking out the show this week and, of course, remind you to follow up on all of the information you get in this week's show over at the MedicCast blog. That's at MedicCast.com/blog. Over there, you'll find a show notes link at the top of the page. Go ahead and take a moment and follow up on all of the information and links to news items and more you find there each week. You can also sign up for our email newsletter that'll bring you those links directly into your email inbox each week if you want. There's a form on the right-hand side of the page. Just go ahead and fill that out, and you can get the MedicCast newsletter for yourself. I also welcome your comments and suggestions by email. So if you want to get back in touch with me, shoot me an email to podmedic@mac.com. Send in your ideas for news links, ideas for future show topics or interviews, whatever comments you might have. I really do look forward to hearing from you, and I'll make sure I get back to you. I work hard to respond back to every email that comes in, so please keep those emails coming. If you want to catch up with me on social media and some of the pages and sites out there, you can find me at most places under the handle PodMedic. So you can catch me over at Twitter at twitter.com/PodMedic or Facebook at facebook.com/PodMedic. Friend or follow me over there. Also, don't forget to check out our MedicCast Facebook page. We now have over 5,000 followers, so head over to facebook.com/MedicCast. Click the like button on the top of the page and join the community over there. That's going to wrap up this week's episode of the MedicCast. Please make sure you spread the word and share the MedicCast with your colleagues and students and friends in the EMS world. I'll be back here each week with new episodes, new interviews, news items, tips, and more every Monday morning to start off your EMS week. Tell somebody else about the MedicCast today. I'm Jamie Davis, the Pod Medic. It's time to close out the show. Don't forget to thank our sponsors. And remember, folks, scene safety, BSI.